first time.
That I okay.
Yeah.
We're back for the first
time. That's right. That's what I said.
You know, Matthew, I'm not quite high enough for that. I am pretty high, but I'm not quite high enough for that.
All right, guys.
Welcome.
Welcome
to an amazing start here.
Welcome to our new podcast. We're starting this is episode one of The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Quit Living and Became Mixed Up Podcasters. I'm Matt. We got David remote on the phone.
And I'm Jake.
And Jake across from me.
Jake O.
And today, our first episode, we are reviewing a movie near and dear to the hearts of David and I. And Jake's new to it, but is on
board. I like it because it's in my wheelhouse because I dig like psychological and slasher horror, and because it is a mix of both. It's like right there in my wheelhouse. I am really appreciative for both of you turning me onto it.
So of course we are talking about the movie Sleepaway Camp, and we're gonna let David give us the deets.
Yes. So released at the very end of the slasher explosion, or better known as the golden age of slashers to us horror fans, which began in 1981 with the original Friday the 13th, Sleepaway Camp is considered one of the most genuinely shocking, controversial, and perhaps intelligent slashers of all time. Written and directed by Robert Hilstick, whom, if you're unfamiliar with any of his other work, you're probably not the only one, because, believe it or not, this is the only film, he's only written and directed two films, being this film and its 2008 sequel, Return to Sleepaway Camp, which, you know, probably isn't worth watching, but, you know, but anyway. So this film, though, speaking of the original solely, notable for casting actual early pubescent children, rather than the typical practice of the day of casting young-looking adult actors in teenage roles.
Okay, so on that note, the cast, start us off here. Most notably for being the movie is most notable for being the debut of young Felissa Rose, who played the main character, Angela Baker. She was only 13 at the time of filming, and she would go on to become something of a horror genre cult icon. She has over 100 acting credits to her name, including but not limited to roles in Zombageddon, Satan's Playground, Victor Crowley, as well as the aforementioned Return to Sleepaway Camp, one of the four sequels to the film, which we may cover at some later point, but God, is that a heaping pile of trash.
Yeah, it's Sleepaway Camp sequels are a thing in their own. So they deserve probably an episode in their own, quite frankly.
Oh, well, you were definitely going to do a Sleepaway Camp 2 at some point, but just know it is a very different movie.
Yes.
She also was a recurring guest on the Joe Bob Briggs... She is a recurring guest on Joe Bob Briggs' Shudder show, The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs, and is popular on the horror and sci-fi convention scene.
Other notables were Catherine Comey, or Cammy, I'm not quite sure how that one's pronounced, but we're just going to roll with it, who played that bitch Meg. Outside of Sleepaway Camp, her majority acting credits consist primarily of guest television roles on like Ghost Whisperer, General Hospital, and The Young and the Restless. She also had a... long-standing role on All My Children from 82 to 83. Yeah.
Yeah, the film is also notable for being the final acting role for veteran actor Michael Kellen, who played the shady and crazy camp owner Mel. Kellen actually had a 30-year acting career spanning back to 1949 and included roles on stage, television, and film, including supporting role in At War with the Army opposite Rat Packers, Dean Martin, and Jerry Lewis.
Whoa.
Television roles in The Twilight Zone, Lost in Space, and Gunsmoke, among many others. He was also nominated for a Tony Award in 1956 for his acting in the hit musical Pipe Dream. So, you know, he had a long... He's probably of all the actors in this film, he probably had the most longest, most renowned, and celebrated career, for sure. Sadly, though, he did die of lung cancer in August 1983 at the age of 61, which was just a few months before Sleepaway Camp was actually released, on November 18th, 1983.
All those fucking stogies, man.
Yeah.
All those stogies.
Yeah.
Other notable members of the cast include Christopher Collette, who played Paul, Ricky's best friend, and Angela's love interest in the film. He was known for a lot of television roles, Magnum P.I., MacGyver, The Cosby Show, as well as playing Albert Costner in the 1995 adaptation of Stephen King's film The Langoliers. And that's another thing we'll probably cover at some point, because there are some batshit crazy acting performances in The Langoliers that really I would love to cover.
Yeah, fair enough.
And finally, with this cast is Robert Earl Jones, the sire to James Earl Jones, Darth Vader himself, the sire.
Really?
I went with sire, yeah.
That's a word.
Yeah, sire. That's
So it's James Earl Jones's father?
Yes, sir. The man whose penis gave us Darth Vader's voice.
Wow. Yes, and Mufasa.
Yeah, and Mufasa. Oh, shit, yeah. Yeah. Anyways, sorry, we got distracted
by James Earl Jones.
But Robert Earl Jones plays Ben the Cook in Sleepaway Camp. He's also had a long and renowned history in Hollywood, going back to 1939, with his first credits leading for Lying Lips in 1939. He was also in supporting roles for The Sting in 1973 with Robert Redford. Great movie.
Yes.
Trading Places another in 83, another phenomenal movie, The Cotton Club in 84, and The Witness in 85. Often overshadowed by his son, Robert was of the first prominent black film stars and was considered a living link to the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s and 30s. He sadly passed away in 2006 at the old age of 96.
Wow.
Right?
It's been a long life, though.
Yeah.
Fruitful life.
I would have guessed he was already in his fucking 80s in the fucking movie.
Yeah.
No, he was actually 70s.
Yeah.
He was in his 70s.
So not that far off.
Not that far off, but still, like, 96. That's a fulfilling life, honestly. Yeah. Like,
well, can you imagine just all the changes he must have seen, you know, just for the treatment of, you know, not just black folks in cinema, but also just in America.
Oh,
from that time.
Right? Oh, yeah. You know? He grew up through Jim Crow to watch Jim Crow evolve into the terrible thing that it still is today.
Yeah, that's true. It still kind of sucks. But considering what it was, he definitely saw a lot of progress in his time. We'll say that.
Yeah, for the grand scheme of everything, yeah, I can agree with that.
Okay, so we're gonna go into story. I must say right now, definite spoiler alerts.
Yes. Well, I mean, for fuck's sake, it's a horror podcast, okay?
So if you haven't seen it, pause right now, go watch it, come back in an hour and a half, pick up where you left off. Hey, how's it going? Welcome back.
I just don't want people yelling at us for spoiling a movie that debuted in 1983.
Yeah.
I know. Well, here's the thing. This is one of those movies that is known, you know, for its twists and turns, okay? So...
it's Shyamalan before Shyamalan.
Exactly. So... yeah, so definitely, if you haven't seen it, go see it for listening to our review of it. If you have, stay tuned.
All right.
Now, before you say that, you say it's Shyamalan before Shyamalan. That is the, like, I was looking for a way to describe it, and that is the...
that's it. Yeah.
Like, you hit the nail on the head.
Boom. All right, the story. We open up, it's 1975. John Baker and his partner Lenny have taken John's children, Angela and Peter, on a boating trip near Camp Arawak. Angela and Peter prank their father by capsizing the boat. They then attempt to swim shore where Lenny is waiting for him. But camp counselor Mariana recklessly strikes John and one of his children with her speedboat, killing them both.
8 years later, Angela now lives with her eccentric aunt, Dr. Martha Thomas.
What a batshit insane fucking character. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
BSC. BSC. Let's just condense it down to BSC. Batshit crazy. BSC.
Yeah. Okay.
She was, I often see her. That's played by Desiree Gould, by the way. Martha's son, Ricky, Aunt Martha sends Angela to Camp Arawak for the first time, along with Ricky, who had attended the camp before Angela's introverted nature makes her a target for ridicule and bullying, mostly from her bunkmate Judy, the camp slut.
Yeah, pretty much.
Bitch. And their counselor, another bitch. Angela's other counselors, Susan, and the camp's head counselor, Ronnie, do what they can to help.
It then leads into this point at which the cook, Artie, attempts to molest Angela. Now, I'm not a fan of chomoism. It's just, I want to hurt people who do this. And, anyways. But Ricky catches him, and...
He really weirdly punches the lettuce.
Yeah.
Love that scene.
Yeah. Awkwardly. And then later, an unseen figure causes Artie to knock over a pot of boiling water and scald himself.
Now, real quick, when we say a pot of boiling water, we're talking about a 5 foot tall
pot. So this scene here, we have a 5 foot pot of boiling, a comical pot of boiling water on top of a stove where the worker has to go up on a
ladder.
A rickety cherry standing on.
These are actual real pots. I have seen and worked with them before.
Incredible.
They're still comically large.
They're still comically large, yes. But they are actually roughly 100 gallon pots.
That's a lot of boiling water.
That is a lot of boiling water.
The thing is, though, that considering how that all is, I could definitely see something like that actually happening.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with a pot that fucking big, and, you know, to the point where you have to actually stand up on a stoop to stir the damn thing.
Oh, yeah. No, now in most higher-end professional kitchens, instead of having big pots like that, they have these giant machine things that are like 500 gallon drums that also are on a lever so you can pour them out safely and stuff like that, like where your everything locks in place so there are no falling and it tips over on you because this thing is mounted to the fucking floor.
But this is also 1975,
80 something. Yeah,
well, taking place in 75, so I don't think those safety measures were in place yet. So,
and before we move on, I just want to spend another second here on Artie. This guy might be the skeeviest character in any of the fucking 80s slashing movies I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of fucking 80s slashing movies, okay?
Yeah, he's garbage. I mean, in opening scene, he's talking about calling them baldies.
Jesus Christ! Yeah. He's sitting there, picking his teeth with a toothpick, that's one this movie does, I think, better than a lot of other slasher movies of the day. You know, they're all known for being sleazy to an extent, but this one really, really gets you in the grease and the sludge.
This one hits certain heartstrings where, like, when Artie does meet his end, instead of, like, oh my god, whodunit, that's a justifiable kill.
Yeah. And I feel like he got kind of what he had coming to him on.
That was karma.
I think the
people in this movie, yeah, it's karma. Exactly. You feel like he deserved to be kind of what you like to do to all chomos, like people like him, you know, is burn him alive.
I have personal experience with this. My aunt Rainbow, her husband died of brain cancer, terribly and painfully, but he also molested both of my cousins. And so, like, when I told her, yeah, he got what he deserved. We haven't spoken in like 6 years.
Yeah, I mean that's the feeling of them. These people are fucked.
I always when I think about that scene, I think of the line from James Earl Jones' dad in that opening scene where Artie's talking about baldies and fucking. He goes, "They're too young to even understand what you're thinking about." And it's like, "Yeah, you sick fuck."
But yeah, you think.
Now. And it should have been, hey, Mel, let's get this guy out of here. He shouldn't be around children.
Yeah, at that point.
Well, Mel, though, as we'll see, is kind of a sleazy motherfucker himself.
This is true.
So.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So, of course, Mel, we forgot to mention, Mel, of course, tries to cover this up as a random accident, does not tell the kids, makes it clear that he cares more about financially saving the camp and his own ass than he has about anything that just happened to his employees or possibly even, as we'll see, the campers.
Bum, bum, bum. Okay, we move on. When campers Kenny and Mike mock Angela at a dance, Ricky and his friend Paul fight them. Paul befriends Angela, and when Kenny drowns, his death is ruled an accident at Mel's insistence.
Even though the
other counselor recounts, I remember that boy was a pretty darn good swimmer. So let's see, where did I leave off? Even though Mel's insistence, although Ronnie and the police officer Frank express doubt, the police officer's acting is awful. I just want to point that out.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and also, we forgot part of that last scene, as the guy, the Artie's getting taken out, Mel talks to the doctor and asks him, what's the prognosis, Doc? And the guy goes, well, he's pretty badly burned all over. And it's like, thank you for that expert medical opinion.
Just watch the man's skin bubbling off his body for about a good, they really get a good close-up of this, too. Make you watch.
Great effects for the time, too. Really great effects for the time.
Yeah. It's really grotesque. Like, you will look at this, damn it. You will watch
So do you know what causes that?
What?
The fat under the skin, when it gets hit with that boiling water, it instantly starts to boil, and so it starts to render, and it starts to cook your fucking face and your skin.
Yeah, there's a little bit of fucking fun for you.
Sorry.
No. We like that.
I am a fan of rather grotesque science.
So Paul asks Angela to attend. They film with him, and after campers, Billy and Mike throw some water balloons at Angela. Billy is subsequently stung to death when someone traps him in a bathroom stall and drops a full-on beehive in it. Mel suspects a killer is in the camp. Well, you think, Mel?
Oh, you think.
Oh, God.
All right. So we continue on here. Angela and Paul's relationship is strained when Paul kisses her. Angela has a flashback in this moment when we see her and her siblings with their father in bed with Lenny.
Oh!
Angela recoils from Paul's advances and runs away. Judy tries to seduce Paul, and Angela finds them kissing. Paul attempts to explain himself to Angela at the lake, but Judy and Meg shoo him away and throw Angela into the water like the couple of bitches they are. After Ricky rescues Angela, children fling sand at them.
Yep.
Ricky comforts Angela and swears revenge on her aggressors.
Also, I just want to point out, at the point where Angela comes across Judy kissing Paul, this is during what is a scene where they are playing Capture the Flag, but I do not believe I don't believe anybody involved in filming the movie knew what Capture the Flag was or how it looked like being played. Because it's just people running in circles in a field grabbing each other's fucking flags.
And then Ricky having the bright idea to sneak attack around. Like, really, kid? Let's be real. Let's be realistic.
And he needs Angela's help. He has to have Angela's help to do it. Anyway.
Yeah. And we need to point out at this point that the movie is indicating pretty clearly that, it's hinting that Ricky may be the person behind this. It's not sure, but it's hinting at that. Keep that in mind going forward.
And Mel is, that is definitely the direction Mel is taking.
Yes. Oh, yeah, most definitely. Now, this leads us into later that evening when everybody's getting ready for the social, and Mel just happens to be talking to Meg, and Meg is pretty much saying, yo, like, I want that D.
She's DTF.
She's DTF. She's DTF.
She's got that grandpa fetish.
She does. So, like, she's going to go get... She's trying to get showered or whatnot, so she winds up going to the cabin next door, which was empty to shower because the water was still on. And while she's there, our killer sneaks up and... can't really say stabs Meg?
More like
butchers her. Like a slab of meat.
Through a piece of plastic.
Through a plastic shower curtain.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's done well, too. It's not one of those kills where they really, like, make you, look at the just brutality of this fucking kill.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's great.
And deserved.
Yeah, well deserved. Well fucking deserved.
Yeah, fuck Mel. I mean, Meg.
Both of them.
Now, yeah. Meg and Mel were supposed to meet up at a specific time, and when Meg doesn't meet up with Mel, Mel goes looking for her, and he winds up stumbling across Judy, who is hiding a boy, and Judy tells him, yo, she went next door to take a shower, like, you know, what else the fuck you want from me? So Mel winds up going next door and stumbles across her body. And at this point, he just is like, nope, it's fucking Ricky. He's doing this to get back at me. That son of a bitch. So. Oh, fuck. Where am I? Sorry.
Excuse the sounds there. He's okay.
Yeah. I have what I would call a brain fart. Sorry about that. Anyways, while all this is going on, some of the younger campers are out camping, and during the scene that our friend David was talking about, where Meg and Judy threw Angela into the water, they also had, like, sand and shit thrown at them, too, by some of the younger kids. And so all those kids are now out in the woods camping, and two of them are like, yo, it's cold, I want to go back. Fuck this shit. So their counselor brings him back, and then when he comes back, he just happens to stumble across four butchered bodies with his hatchet.
The four children that threw the sand. Bum, bum, bum. Hmm? Back at the camp, the killer enters Judy's cabin and murders her, raping her with a hot curling iron while smothering her with a pillow. The camp is then thrown into a panic. Thinking Ricky is the killer, Mel beats him mercilessly, only to be shot in the throat by an arrow by the real killer, which, who knew the real killer was such a great archer? But now we know.
Yeah, right.
Frank is called, and searches with the counselors for the missing campers continue. Paul is at the beach with Angela, who suggests they go skinny dipping. Frank discovers Ricky unconscious but alive. Ronnie and Susie find Angela sitting on the beach humming with Paul, whose head appears to be resting on her lap as she strokes his hair and hums a little tune. Flashback then shows Aunt Martha welcoming the survivor of the boat accident into her home. It's revealed that the real Angela is the child who died in the accident, while Aunt Martha took custody of the surviving Peter, reasoning that since she already had a son and always wanted a little girl, that she would raise Peter as Angela instead.
Back in the present, Angela leaps to her feet holding a hunting knife, allowing Paul's severed head to fall onto the ground. Shocked, Ronnie exclaims, how can it be? My God, she's a boy! As the nude and blood-covered Angela stands before the horrified Susie and Ronnie, hairy male genitalia in full view. And let me tell you, this scene is fucking haunting.
Yeah, Angela's face, yeah. She's like stuck with her mouth wide open.
Grotesquely open. Like, it's basically what they did here. They got a plaster cast of Angie of Felicity's face, and they put it on top of just a dude. So it's not even like a guy in makeup. That's like a mask on top of a dude with his cock out.
And that's a dick.
Yeah, that's a dick. I mean, and that scene right there is probably what most, you know, it's the shock. It's probably the greatest ending of any 80s slasher, honestly.
Yeah, nobody sees that coming the first time. What did you just recently?
Well, having seen it twice in about a week span. Yeah, no, first time. I'm not gonna lie. Like, I'm good at knowing. Like,
figuring out.
Yeah, I'm good at picking shit up real quick and early, and I kind of already knew Angela was Peter. But I didn't, like, I just, I'm like, all right.
You weren't concrete on it yet.
It wasn't so much that I wasn't concrete on it. It was more of a, I want to see how this plays out anyways.
Right.
You know? Because I'm a fan of the art, you know? So, no, even though I knew, I didn't care that I knew. I enjoyed it anyways.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I don't know. Am I weird for being like that?
No. Not at all. Some release notes. Sleepaway Camp had a limited regional release on November 18, 1983, according to the American Film Institute. It had its premiere in L.A. the following spring on May 25, 1984, and the film went on to reportedly gross $11 million on a $350,000 budget.
You know, 1983, that's not bad.
That's pretty good, yeah, especially for the budget under $500,000.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the allure for these movies. That's why there were so many slasher movies made in just a couple years there in the 80s, because you could make these literally, you know, on a weekend on the shoestring budget and make millions off of these, dude.
That's insane.
And as far as critical reception goes, you know, like most slasher movies of the era, you know, Sleepaway Camp was shit on by critics of the day. Like pretty much every other one was, you know, pretty much. A lot of people compared it to a sleazier, possibly homophobic Friday the 13th ripoff. And of course, you know, that can be, you know, I guess that can be kind of, I understand, you know, kind of linking, you know, the fact the children had, you know, two male parents, and I guess kind of the sexual, what's the word for it? I guess confusion that kind of causes whatever, you know. It was a different time, 1983.
Yeah.
You know, very different time. It was not like, ideas of, you know, homosexuality were not as accepting as they are today. We'll say that. Eugene Maleska, a reviewer of the Chula Vista Star News, deemed it a tasteless picture about mysterious murders at a summer youth camp that obscenely blends beheadings, stabbings, pubescent impulses, homosexuality, and transvesticism with a cast of junior high schoolers. So, you know, and of course, I cannot find a Robert Ebert, a Siskel and Ebert review, but assuming that they, you know, knowing how they felt about slasher movies, I'm pretty sure they probably hated this movie, too.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that goes without saying.
Right.
But this film was one of those flicks, like a lot of that, you know, it's kind of undergone a great modern-day reassessment, you know. On Rotten Tomatoes, Sleepaway Camp currently holds a 78% approval rating.
Damn, that's pretty good.
Yeah, based on 23 reviews. The consensus reads, Sleepaway Camp is a standard teen slasher elevated by occasional moments of John Waters-esque weirdness in a twisted ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
could see that. I mean, John Waters would have taken it a lot farther.
But the prolapsed asshole?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Surfing Bird, anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's legitimately some shit in this movie that, like, I've never seen in a horror movie before or really even since.
Like,
I mean,
like Judy getting raped with a hot curling iron.
Yeah, I mean, like, you see that shit maybe in, like, Italian Giallo films, but those are, you know, that's a different kind of thing. Like, American slasher movies, there's always kind of a, I feel like there's kind of a cutoff point to what they would and wouldn't do. You have a barely a pubescent girl getting raped to death by a curling iron.
Yeah. We wouldn't really say raped to death, more like being raped while being killed. Because she was being suffocated to death, and then just to add insult to injury, was being raped by a hot curling iron.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Brutal is,
So in his book, The Pleasure and Pain of Cult Horror Films, A Historical Survey, Pezik characterized Sleepaway Camp as elevating the kids to the position of the movie's mass protagonist. It becomes a tricky metaphor of the unspeakable pains and anxieties of growing up. He further commented on the film's conclusion, the epiphanous ending brings Sleepaway Camp further away from the likes of Friday the 13th, and closer to such 1980s slashers with a twist as Happy Birthday to Me, another good one, and April Fool's Day, another good one. But Hiltzik's movie goes even further than that in this case. The denouement doesn't just add a new dimension to everything we saw up to this point, but it pushes the way deep into our minds and stays with us forever, which I totally agree with.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this... It's the reason why I've seen this film like 10 times. It's, you know.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to watch it again with Matt multiple times.
It's definitely worth watching a lot. You know, I mean, just the fact that it goes into issues like, you know, transvestitism, you know, gender dysphoria, even the whole, you know, the whole repressed homosexuality, you know, as a, you know, in for people who experience trauma. You know, these are all things that never were discussed in horror movies.
Or it maybe not even like the repressed homosexuality because of the trauma, but more or less the repressed homosexual or the forced homosexuality because of the forced gender dysphoria.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's just there's so much to this movie that really like.
There's depth upon depth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's for a slasher movie, you know, that is beyond, you know, what any real slasher movie, especially in that time period, really would get into. That's brilliant. You know, it's deeply intelligent, deeply disturbing. It's a great film.
Really is.
Yeah, I agree.
And like most of the
Go ahead. I would even argue, I mean, personally, that it may be, you know, the best pound-for-pound slasher of the golden era. You know, some say Friday the 13th, some say Maniac, but I feel personally that given just the deeper, you know, the deeper meanings, deeper contextuality, and discussions and themes discussed in the film, I think and the fact that they actually use real kids as opposed to teenagers appearing to be kids, that it gives the whole movie a whole other level of just grounded in reality that wasn't present in most 80s slasher films.
And that's something that I saw in a lot of the like IMDb negative reviews, where people saying like just dogging on the acting, and it's like, well, yeah, because they're fucking kids. They're not experienced actors for the most part. So
yeah,
and I think it adds, like you said, to the realism. I don't see why that's a negative for so many people, but I feel like people on IMDb just like to write big words and shit on things.
I'm sorry. When it comes to my 80s slashers, the campier, the acting,
the better. That's what you expect.
You expect it to be over-exaggerated acting, over-dramatic bullshit. Like, if you don't get that, then why are you calling yourself an 80s slasher?
Exactly. Honestly, I would argue that Felicity Rose's performance, you know, for someone her age and lack of experience at the time, it's great. I mean, compare her to, like, older actors who were, like, in The Burning or even some of the Friday movies, and she's great.
She can hold her own. Her ability to play just how shy she comes across and how real, like, you believe it. You believe that she's
overly,
like,
introverted.
That's that.
Yeah. Possibly traumatized, and, you know, you always get something more to her going on, but you're not really sure what it is. You know?
There's almost like a level of, like, blankness to her face.
I wouldn't really say it's blankness. It's more of, and I guess this is just coming from somebody who looks at life in a similar aspect to this, of when people treat you like shit, you shut up and plot their deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, because it makes you feel good on the inside. I don't ever act out on it.
Right.
And because that's murder. I'm sorry, no. But, like, if you piss me off, stab you.
Well, I mean, you know, and being a introverted, shy kid who grew up being picked on a lot, you know, I definitely, you know, I can definitely relate to her, you know? I think there are a lot of kids out there who are shy growing up, introverted, are picked on for it, don't necessarily act on those feelings. But you're right. I dreamed all the time as a kid of killing my bullies.
See,
brutally.
See, I was kind of the opposite. Like, I was extroverted, and I was bullied, and I became even more extroverted because I was bullied. And then finally, I snapped and started beating the shit out of the kids who bullied me. Now, granted, my dad started teaching me to, like, defend myself at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
In case that it came to a point where I needed to, you know, which at one point it finally did. And I beat the shit out of a couple kids because they were fucking being bullies and doing bully shit. And they wouldn't let me just move on. And they pushed me that one time too many, and, well, a base of my palm hit the bottom of a jaw, a knee went to a nutsack.
That's a more reasonable reaction.
Yes, but I'm the one that got expelled.
Yeah, I mean, at least you didn't stab anybody in the back while they're taking a shower.
True.
So you mean you didn't think of us shoving like a hot curling iron or some guy's butthole?
No, but I did think of like curb stomping.
The thought of murder by beehive never crossed your
mind? That one did cross my mind. Because I knew one of them was allergic to bees. So I'm like, I should just.
The only question is, where do you get the beehive?
Well, this is Lakeside. They're all over the place.
Okay, but, I mean, they're going to attack you as soon as you get... Okay, we're not going to fucking get into logistics of finding a beehive and attacking somebody and killing it with said beehive.
I'm a tactician.
We're going to find a massive stick.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm a tactician.
I mean, we could sit here and plan this all out, but then, I mean, we're kind of plotting a murder, and that...
A fictitious... fictitious...
But is it really murder when this is retroactive to 30 years ago?
Yes, this was like 20 years ago, 23 years ago. So this is retroactive. This is all in imagination land.
I'm gonna say Henry Zebrowski would approve.
Yes.
All right, David. It's time that we rate this movie. I'm calling mine the Mad-O-Meter, and I'm giving it a 5 out of 5 on the Mad-O-Meter. For me, personally, this is one of my favorite slasher horror films ever. So. I gotta give it the perfect rating, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, as far as slasher films, I would definitely give it a 5 out of 5. We'll say in this case a 5 out of 5 shockingly revealed male penises on a female body. As with most slasher movies, only knock you're gonna have, obviously, is the acting, but again, like we talked about, these are kids. These are first-time actors. It's like, what the fuck ever. You know, you don't watch these movies for the acting. You watch them for the kills, and this movie has some of the most brutal, grisly kills I've ever seen in a slasher film up to that point. The ending, I still think, is the best of any 80s slasher. Maybe the only other I could think of that had that great of an ending was the original Friday the 13th. And it started it all, and that's a great company to have. So yeah, I definitely agree. It's 5 out of 5.
I'm going to call this a unanimous fivers. Because, right. it hits all of my key points when I go in for a horror film. It's got that underlying psychological theme to it, but it's still a great, camp, shittily acted 80s slasher film.
Love it.
It's perfect. It's like, for a slasher movie in that time, it's like it has everything you can want and more. They went way over, you know... I mean, Hesek, I believe was his name. Yeah, Hesek. He may have never done anything again in his life that was worth... I guess he became a lawyer. But, my God, did he make the perfect slasher movie here.
He one-hit wondered him.
He did?
The Mad-O-Meter. So, David, I see here you have discussing our next film, but we never discuss it, so I'm guessing you have something in mind already.
I do. I was thinking, since we did, you know, disturbing slasher movie this week, I was thinking our next one could be another somewhat disturbing slasher movie. Don't Go in the House.
Don't Go in the House. Let's see.
It's 1979 horror movie, slasher flick. It's very similar, very psychological. I know that's up your alley, Jake. And I think you guys are going to enjoy it.
Awesome.
We will watch that this week, and
I'm going to have to make it a point to come over multiple times this week to watch that with you.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, this is nice. We're about to wrap it up in a nice little 40 minutes. We're still trying to feel our way through how we want to do this, but I think this went off without a hitch.
Ish.
Well, there's a few little things we can
There's hiccups, clean but up. I mean, there's cleanups, but, you know, shit happens.
So, David, final thoughts?
See this movie. If you haven't seen this fucking movie, Sleepaway Camp, go see it right fucking now.
Do it.
Right goddamn meow.
Right now. All right. For David and Jake, we are the Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Quit Living and Became Mixed Up Podcasters, and we will see you next time.